Well, it's good to see everybody this morning. In my Bible, I've opened to the fourth division of the book of Hebrews. I'll ask you to do the same, please, if you will. Hebrews 4. Are we going to have the PowerPoint this morning? Are we working on it? There we go. Progress? Maybe? Ah, good. I think I could preach without PowerPoint, but it's been a while. They asked me to say the prayer yesterday at noon. I said, I can't. I don't have PowerPoint. You just kind of get used to things. It is great to see all of you this morning. Wonderful that we can be together. I know many of you are visiting with this church family this morning, and we thank all of you so much for being here and being a part of our efforts this week. Appreciate especially all the young moms who are here this morning. We're here yesterday morning, bringing your kids and getting them up and doing everything that has to be done in order to get a family here. We thank you for doing that very much. I'm enjoying being with you a great deal, and especially getting to be with these other speakers. I appreciated both Jeff and Ralph last night, and thought Ralph's lesson last night as he dealt with the family was just outstanding. I want to say something to you that Ralph would not. Norm mentioned about the marriage retreats that Ralph was a part of, and Ralph just casually, as he passed by a point or two, mentioned something about those, and he would never say this to you, so let me say it today. If you ever have an opportunity to be a part of one of the marriage retreats that Ralph and Mark Broyles put on, they've been in Florida for the past 3 years, about to be there again next week. They're doing these in Chattanooga. Next year they're going to Branson, Missouri. If you ever have an opportunity, you will be blessed by being there. Vicki and I have gone in Florida the last 3 years and have taken lots of our families from Temple Terrace. I think the first one 3 years ago in Florida, if I recall, we had 26 people from Temple Terrace there. And it's a wonderful weekend just to be together, but it's a wonderful weekend to learn. And you would enjoy that. You would enjoy that immensely. It is just wonderful to be with you this morning. I had told you the other day I have a little trouble seeing your clock, so I'm going to take my watch off here and I'm going to put it down. I'll try to remember to pay attention to that. I was told, you know, up here in Alabama that over where Jeff preaches at, what's that called? Is it Oaklawn? Oakland. I was told that over at Oakland where Jeff preaches that there was a little boy in his congregation that brought a friend to church one Sunday. And little boy had never been to a church anywhere at all, so he didn't have any idea about what was going on. And so as things began to get going, the little boy would lean over and ask his buddy, and say, what does that mean? And so a man got up to lead singing. Little boy leaned over. He said, what does that mean? And he explained to him what he was about to do. And men got up in front of the table to pass the Lord's Supper, and little boy leaned over and he said, what does that mean? And he told him what that meant, what he was about to do. And Jeff got up to preach. Jeff took his watch off and he put it up here on the podium just like this. Little boy leaned over. He said, what does that mean? The little boy said, that doesn't mean anything at all. So I will try to make that mean something and remember that is there. Well, it is like an unwelcome guest. It follows you everywhere. It's waiting for you when you get up in the morning. It sits down and reads the morning newspaper with you. It travels in your car with you to the office. It finds you at lunch, follows you home in the evening. If you sit down to watch television, it will be right there with you. If you leave town, it will pack its bags and it will travel with you, and it will be waiting for you when you arrive back home. And we're not talking about an annoying relative here. We're not talking about a high school or college friend that, you know, in the words of the Bruce Springsteen song, Glory Days, has never been able to move beyond that. And we're talking about something much more sinister, something far worse. We're talking this morning about temptation. The fact is that no matter where you go, no matter what you do, temptation is there. It slips silently and seductively into our hearts, and it rattles our convictions, often to the very core of who we are. The world welcomes temptation, even plays into its hand. And so the world just has this kind of universal mantra that I just couldn't help myself, or excuses it with advertising campaigns such as, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. But it doesn't, not just Vegas, it will work almost anywhere for the world. It may be New Year's Eve, it can be a birthday, an anniversary, a vacation, where we just come to believe that because we are out of our normal circumstance, all bets are off and we now can behave any way that we desire. But for the Christian, it's different. It's no less real, but it's different for us. And it is the understanding that for us, this is our challenge. And so it is seen in our language. We talk about fighting temptation and fleeing temptation and avoiding temptation. But the one thing that we can never do is have temptation leave us and not come back. In fact, it is a daily battle. It is a battle that continues and will continue throughout our life. Well, I'm trying to advance my slide here, and the devil evidently is tempting me. And I'm kind of like Gary, I want to just choke it right now. Any chance? Maybe? We're working on it, okay. It's promising. Should we pray about that? We don't have time to fast, but we'll see. Well, we can. Oh, there we go. All right. There we go. The fact is that we have to battle that every day. The front lines of battle tells us that I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. There are a lot of folks, I think, who are baptized into Christ, and somehow, some way, maybe because we've not told them the fine print, come to believe that whatever their problems were of temptation are not going to plague them anymore, that somehow they'll have a divine exemption from all of that, no more desire to do evil. We need to understand that when you and I became a Christian, we were absolutely on the top of the mountain spiritually. But that does not mean that we were exempt from anything. We need to make no mistake about that. Our adversary, the devil, to use Peter's language, will relentlessly seek our destruction. When you and I became a Christian, the day that happened was the day that our wanted poster went up in the post office of hell. Gary mentioned yesterday Matthew 4 and the parallel account in Luke 4 of Jesus and the triad of temptations that he faced. The fact of the matter is that he was tempted. We're going to read a passage in the morning that says, in a moment, that says he was tempted in all points like as we are, and yet without sin. But what I want us to consider this morning is that Jesus also said, remember, the servant is not above his master. And if our master was tempted in all points, we can be sure that we as servants will be as well. And the fact is that we will struggle with temptation throughout our lives. We are never going to reach a level, never. We're never going to reach a level of spiritual maturity where we can honestly say, I am now beyond, I'm beyond seduction by my adversary. Again, the fact is that at various stages of life, we're going to experience intense temptation. Doesn't necessarily mean that we're out of step with God. It may just mean that the devil perceives us as being so strong that he has to give us some extra attention to try to derail us. I think he does that for churches. If this congregation of God's people is going to continue to flourish and thrive as it has over the past several years, if it's going to continue to make progress spiritually, numerically, in strengthening members and harmony that allows that to happen, you can be absolutely sure, ladies and gentlemen, that at this moment the devil is formulating a plan custom-made for you to try to derail the progress that you are making. And I think he does that individually as well. The great heroes of biblical faith are men like Abraham and Joseph and Moses and Saul and David and Solomon and Paul and Peter and even the Lord Jesus Christ again, being tempted in all points like as we are. It wasn't because they were so weak. It was because they were so strong. The temptation that you grapple with may attract someone else or it may not, and vice versa. For one individual, the temptation may be gossip and lying. For somebody else, it might be bitterness or hatred. For one individual, it might be greed. For another, lust. For one individual, it might be alcohol or drugs. For somebody else, it might be gambling. And again, if you struggle with any of these or any of the other multitude of temptations, it's not necessarily an indication of weakness. It is an acknowledgement of reality, an acknowledgement that Satan wants an advantage of us, and therefore we must not be ignorant of his devices, his schemes, his methodologies, the blueprint that he has to try to destroy your life and my life. I'm just saying to you this morning that as we need to be aware, as we talked yesterday morning, as we need to be aware of the gifts, the talents, the abilities which God has endued us, by the same token, we need to be brutally honest about those areas of weakness and vulnerability that we know we have. Righteousness is not being exempt from temptation. Righteousness is facing the temptation as a daily reality and doing our best to overcome it. So maybe this morning, that's where we need to start. Maybe we need to start this morning with just an acknowledgement that temptation is inevitable and we ought to expect that. Again, the fact of the matter is that nobody is exempt and nobody is invincible. Nobody. Nobody is exempt. Nobody is invincible. When you and I became a Christian, our long-standing issues, difficulties, problems with temperament or personal relationships or personal lust or personal temptation did not mystically and magically disappear. And so this morning, if you're here, whether you are a rookie Christian or whether you are a seasoned veteran, and whether you are a weak Christian who's about to go down for the count, or whether you are the spiritual heavyweight champion of the world, Satan will persist in trying to derail your progress and will do so relentlessly. I want you to look at the screen and let's consider this very familiar passage. Remember what James said? Let nobody say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted of God. Now, James would disabuse that idea by simply saying, listen, logically that can't happen. Because God cannot be tempted by evil, nor did he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own individual desire. It seems to me that James is trying to impress upon us that the devil knows how to entrap us. I've been a Christian for 39 years. I was baptized when I was 14. You can do the math, I'm 53. But I've been a Christian for 39 years. And it is still true today that I have areas of vulnerability, areas that I know personally I must be vigilant about. Now, a non-Christian doesn't have to worry about that. A non-Christian doesn't have to struggle to resist sin. They don't have to wrestle with guilt. They don't have to try to restrain their thought life that might lead them to behaviors that would be antithetical to what God wants. But being a Christian, as we saw Monday night in our lesson about discipleship, being a disciple of Jesus means that we have committed ourselves to a truly higher calling, and we're going to try to rise above that which would drag us down. What an amazingly honest passage we have in Romans 7. When Paul just says about himself, look, I do not understand my own actions. I do not do what I want. I am doing the very thing that I hate. And so I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. Now we can argue that Paul was talking about his pre-Christian conversion and all of that, but the fact of the matter is that it seems to be saying, look, I understand, I may be an apostle of Jesus Christ, and yet these are the things that challenge me. And so often, when I want to do what's right, I end up doing the opposite. Is there anybody in this audience who can't say that there have been points in time in your life when you violated the law of God, and at the very moment you did it, you knew it was a violation of God's law, and you made a conscious decision to violate it anyway? We all have. And that shouldn't perhaps surprise us, given, to get where I asked you to open a moment ago, that our high priest can sympathize with our weaknesses because in all points he was tempted as we are, and yet without sin. And so, he rises from the waters of baptism and he is led by the Spirit into the desert, and there he faces that triad of temptations. What interests me this morning is that at the end of that narrative, both Gospels say that the devil left him for a season. But the fact of the matter is that while he may have left him then, the devil dogged his step for the remainder of his life. Until finally Jesus is on a cross in a day that surely was orchestrated in the pit of hell, and he's on the cross, and one of Satan's ambassadors cries out and says, look, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. We'll believe you then. The point of it is that the Christian life is not a playground. It is a battleground. No wonder the Apostle Paul said in Ephesians 6, you've got to put on the whole armor of God. Without some protection, you're in desperate problems spiritually. Secondly, this morning, temptation is dangerous. And we need to respect that. Temptation is dangerous because sin, all sin, brings consequences. We need to understand that. Let me just, as an aside, say just a word about that if I may. Sin, all sin, brings consequences, and we need to understand. We so often confuse forgiveness and consequences. I think young people, oftentimes especially, want to say, can't you forgive me? Well, yes, I can. Ralph talked about that last night. I want to tell you, amen to that. But there's a difference between forgiveness and the consequences that may be brought to bear because of sinful behavior. You know, you think about the story of David and Bathsheba. We'll reference this again in a moment. But David and Bathsheba, I never yet have taught that section of text in a Bible class where it says that when the child was born, that the child died. I think I've never taught that somebody hasn't raised their hand and said, you know what, Don, that's just not fair. That baby was innocent. It's just not fair. You know what the answer to that is? You're exactly right, that's not fair. There's nothing fair about that. Since when does sin and the devil ever play by anybody's rules? But the fact of the matter is that while David, the old prophet said, was forgiven, the consequences were severe. And so temptation is dangerous because of what it brings. A couple of passages to think about here. It was Peter who said, if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, they are through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, if they are again entangled and overcome, the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. Or Hebrews 10, if we sin willfully, we don't stumble, we don't just fall into something accidentally, but if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but rather a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversary. You know, I know that when I read that verse, or those two verses, I can almost hear somebody saying, you know what, Don, I'm telling you what, we probably shouldn't be trying to motivate people through fear. I want to tell you, motivating by fear sometimes is a mighty fine thing. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the beginning of wisdom is oftentimes the last line of defense against sin. Fear of being caught. Fear of disease. Fear of death. Fear of embarrassment. Fear of a loss of reputation. Fear of damage done to our children or our mate. Fear of detection. Fear of hell. Sometimes fear is a mighty good motivator. Tell me that didn't undergird a little bit of what Paul said in Galatians 6. He said, look, don't be deceived. Let's not be naive about this. God is not mocked. God didn't have to read the newspaper this morning to figure out what's in your heart. He is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he reap. It's inevitable. You sow to the flesh, you of the flesh reap corruption. Sow to the spirit you reap everlasting life. Somebody has well said that the pain of reaping always exceeds the pleasure of the sowing. And we need to be honest about that too. There is, in fact, pleasure in the sowing of sin. Sin brings pleasure. We need to be honest about that. We need to be honest with our young people about that, that sin brings pleasure. If it didn't bring pleasure, we wouldn't be having this conversation this morning. There wouldn't be any temptation to it. The Hebrew writer was right when he talked about Moses, and he said he rejected the pleasures of sin, choosing the people of God and what came with that choice. I've said many times, if somebody ever tells you that sin doesn't bring any pleasure, either number one, they are lying, or number two, they're too old to remember. Because the Bible just says it does. But the pain of reaping always exceeds the pleasure of the sowing. Because usually before very long, with most sins, before very long, the pleasure is gone. And now there is that harvest. And that can be trouble. That harvest may be loneliness, or disease, or guilt, or inadequacy, or depression, desperation. Jeff referenced last night, kind of an old cliche that everybody's heard. You sow a thought, you reap a deed. You sow a deed, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a character. You sow a character, you reap a destiny. Well, thirdly, we need to be honest and acknowledge that temptation is varied. And we need to be understanding of that. The passage I would have us look at here is in 1 John 2, familiar territory, where he says, don't love the world nor the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. All that is in the world, lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, these are not of the Father, these are the world. I wonder if we were writing that today in 2010, if we might have interpreted the original language a little differently, I wonder if we would have said, look, all that is in the world, sensualism, materialism, and egotism. Sensualism, materialism, and egotism, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life, these are not of the Father, these are of the world. And the point of it is, ladies and gentlemen, that there are various kinds of temptation. Gary said yesterday morning that when he was young, there were certain things that he really worried about being tempted with. And I think that's true for most all of us. Maybe you overcome the lust and passion of your younger years only to be consumed and caught by materialism in middle age. But maybe you navigate middle age successfully and you overcome materialism, and then in your old age you are tempted by Satan with bitterness and pride and cynicism. Well, the point of it is that temptation is always individual in nature. We read a moment ago in James 1 and verse 14, everyone is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. It's not one size fits all. The other day in Temple Terrace, I went at lunchtime to a little mom and pop sandwich and soup shop that we have in Temple Terrace. Some of you have been there. It's called the Old World Cheese Shop, and I go there an awful lot because they make homemade soup every day, and I like soup. And I was standing in line waiting to pay the owner. Her name is Gail. And so I'm standing behind a guy just waiting my turn. And when there's a fellow in front of me and a lady in front of her, and when she finishes and moves, and Gail looks at the fellow in front of me, she says, "Man, I didn't hardly recognize you. You have lost so much weight." And he laughed and he said, "Yeah, I'm not losing weight. I'm buying bigger clothes." Well, that doesn't really help anything, does it? I mean, you can buy that one-size-fits-all garment that really, you know, will fit an elephant, but it's not helping you any. Temptation is not that way. It's not one-size-fits-all. It is tailor-made to our individual weakness and circumstance. What may seduce me may be no seduction to you whatsoever, and vice versa. That's why, and listen to me careful, ladies and gentlemen, it's why we need to be very careful about ever saying, "You know what? I don't understand how anybody could do that. I just don't understand how anybody could ever do that." Well, you know why? Because it's not a temptation to you. But the things that tempt you, that other individual may look at you and say, "I can't for the life of me understand why anybody would do that." We need to be careful about that. The fact is that temptations are individual in nature. It's why Peter said that all of us need to have our eyes open and our head up, looking around, being sober and vigilant, because our adversary, the devil, walks about on those feline feet trying to find somebody upon whom he can pounce and not do us harm. That's not the point. He wants to devour, to destroy. And so we need to understand finally that temptation can be overcome, and we need to confront it. Now, I want you to look at a verse with me, and we're going to reference this two or three times here. First of all, it was J. Irwin Lutzker in one of his writings that said, "Temptation is not a sin, it's a call to battle." And I like that. We have sung for generations in our churches that old hymn, "Yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin." Temptation is not the sin, it's a call to battle. Look at this passage with me again. "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able." Look at this phrase. "With the temptation will make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it." Now, temptation can be overcome, and we need to confront it. The problem sometimes is that we just don't take it very seriously. I pulled up behind a car at a stoplight in Temple Terrace not very long ago that had a bumper sticker on it that said, "Lead me not into temptation. I'm perfectly capable of finding it on my own." And I think that's the way a lot of people deal with that, as though it's just some kind of theology that can fit on a bumper sticker and we can make light of it and go on because, you know, this really doesn't have much to do with real life. The fact of the matter is that temptation can be overcome. We sometimes excuse our failures by arguing, you know, "Well, it's just impossible. It's just impossible. I couldn't help myself." So, yes, I was immoral. I will grant that. I will acknowledge that. But you have to understand, I am a single adult and I'm lonely. Or you have to understand, my marriage isn't as fulfilling as I would like for it to be. Or, you know what, this person that I work with, the chemistry between us is just so strong that surely God meant for us to be together. Or yes. Okay, I'm a little materialistic. I will grant you that. I'll confess that. But you don't understand. I mean, I grew up with nothing. I grew up poor. And I want to make sure that my kids have better, have more things than I did. Well, okay, yeah, I'll acknowledge, I'll confess. I do gripe a lot, and I do complain a lot. But you have to understand, I have really good ideas, and people need to listen to me. And things would be better if people listened to me. Or, look, yes, okay, I'm that way. I'll acknowledge that. But you have to understand, that is just the way God made me. And the way God made me has become the universal excuse for everything. We need to remember that God doesn't traffic in the immoral, the unrighteous, the ungodly, or the unholy. And so God expects us to go on the offensive. I think God expects us to be proactive. Sometimes, depending on the circumstance and what a person's trying to say in athletics, sometimes we say the best offense is a good defense. But if a team is playing in a particular way, sometimes folks will say the best defense is a good offense. For a Christian, oftentimes, the best defense is a good offense. Remember the old country song? You've got to stand for something. Or what? You'll fall for everything. And so to be proactive, I would suggest to you this morning that we need to do four things. Number one, we need to seek God's help. We need to realize that there are some resources that are available to us, and we need to use those. In fact, in the Mountain Message, the sixth division of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus, when he was teaching disciples to pray, said, "Pray to God and say, 'Do not lead us into temptation, but,'" look at the language, "'deliver us from the evil one.'" We need some help. Would you deliver us from the evil one? Listen to James. Submit to God. Well, that's one part of the equation. What's the other? Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. What's the point of that? The point is that when his heart is submitted to God and we resist the devil, God will help deliver us. We forget sometimes that God's in the delivering business. He delivered the Israelites out of slavery. Daniel from a lion's den. Bartimaeus from blindness. A Gadarene from demon possession. Peter from drowning. And at least initially, the Apostle Paul from execution. No wonder he wants me to pray, "Deliver me from the evil one." Let me tell you some of the ways that God may do that, at least one way God may do that. Let's go back to what we read a moment ago in 1 Corinthians 10 and 13. "No temptation has taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, not allow you to be tempted above what you are able to bear. But with every temptation, he will provide a way of escape." He will provide a door for you to walk through to escape. The problem is sometimes we pray for God to deliver us from the evil one, and God opens the door for us, and we decide not to walk through it. I'll give you an example. We mentioned a moment ago about David and Bathsheba. It's an interesting story, isn't it? Finds David behaving in a way that was certainly out of character for him. And so David is up and he is walking one night. Evidently he can't sleep and he's walking in his rooftop garden. And we don't know why he couldn't sleep. Maybe Leno was a rerun that night. Maybe there was too much spice in the mutton, but he's up and he's walking. And he looks and he spies a woman that isn't just attractive. The text says she was very beautiful. And so he summons his servant and he says, "Bring her to me." And the servant says, "Master, are you asking me to bring to you Bathsheba, who is the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" What did God just do? He just opened a door through the mouth of a servant. She is the wife of Uriah the Hittite. I'd like to have heard the rest of that conversation. I wonder if the servant said, "Thousand pardons, Your Majesty. I'm sorry, allergies, I don't think I heard you correctly. I thought you said you wanted me to bring to you the wife of Uriah the Hittite." That's right. "Bring her to me." What did God do through the mouth of the servant? He opened a door and David refused to walk through it and escape. We need to seek God's help, but ladies and gentlemen, we've got to cooperate. Secondly, we need to flee from temptation. That would seem to be obvious, wouldn't it? Our problem is that sometimes we feel so strong that we just feel like no matter what our situation or circumstance is, we'll be okay. And so, I can go to that bar with my friends, I just won't drink. I can go to spring break down in Mexico, and really it's all going to be okay. I can go to that website, and somehow I can still keep my mind pure. Solomon said, a wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool boasts or rages and is self-confident. A man who doesn't fear and depart from evil, ultimately, is a fool. You know, the Apostle Peter, I think, made an admirable commitment to the Lord. He said, Lord, I will never deny you. Regardless of what anybody else does, I will never deny you. I've got to tell you, I've heard preachers take the Apostle Peter to task and say, what an arrogant boast, and no wonder he got in trouble, and he shouldn't have ever said that, and it was just kind of presumptuous on his part. Ladies and gentlemen, what are you wanting to say? I tell you, I want everybody who comes out of the waters of baptism to say, Lord, I will never deny you. Don't you want people to have that attitude? But the problem was that Peter warmed himself with the enemy's fire. And peer pressure can be awesome. I read a story years ago about a young cub reporter in a little community was sent by his local paper out to the nursing home. A lady had turned 100 years old, and so he was going to interview her, and he went and walked through the labyrinth of halls and found the lady and interviewed her. And finally, before he left, he said, tell me, what's the best thing about being a centenarian? What's the best thing about being 100 years old? And she looked at him and she said, well, there's not much peer pressure at my age. Well, that's right. But I tell you, for most of the rest of us, there is. We need to avoid the people and places that harm us rather than help us. And so you know what? If you have a problem with gambling, you need to stay away from websites that promote gambling. If you have a problem with materialism, then spending hour after hour after hour at the mall is probably not where you need to be. I mean, if you go to the mall over in Huntsville, and go to the directory, and you find the big red X, and it says beside it, you are here again. You're probably going too often. If you have a problem with whatever, you just fill in the blank there. Then you need to avoid the people and the places that provide the opportunity to get in a problem with that. There is a word for people who flirt with temptation. They are victims. I read a story about a group that were on safari over in Africa, and somebody in the group asked their African safari guide. They said, is it true that wild animals will not attack you if you're carrying a torch? The old guide looked at him and said, depends on how fast you carry the torch. No wonder, Paul said, we've got to flee from this. The Latin word is fugitivus, a fugitive. Remember the movie The Fugitive a few years ago? This was a man who was on run for his life. That's the language of Paul. And then thirdly, we need to learn to say no immediately. We need to learn to say no immediately. Gary, have you ever petted a live rattlesnake on its head? Okay, because I figured you were about to mess up my illustration. Good, I'm glad you haven't done that. That's one of the few things in life, evidently, Gary has not done. Why is it, ladies and gentlemen, that we don't try to pet a live rattlesnake on its head? Well, because we don't want to get that close. I mean, we don't want to be that close to being bitten. We know that there's an area there. There's a parameter of danger. And if we invade that, we know that nothing good is going to come from that. We don't get as close as we can to a rattlesnake to see how close we can get without being bitten. Why do we do that with sin? You know, some things shouldn't be entertained. It's interesting in Matthew 16, and I don't have time for us to turn there, let me just give you the Reader's Digest version, if I may. In Matthew 16, when Jesus comes to the coast of Caesarea Philippi and has that dialogue about who do men say that I am, and Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, and what a great confession that is. And then Jesus begins to show them that he must go to Jerusalem, be delivered in the hands of sinful men. He will be crucified. On the third day, he will rise again. You remember what Peter said? Far be it from you, Lord. This will never happen to you. And Jesus didn't say, boy, that's appealing. Maybe we could think about that. I wonder if maybe there is another way. Now, you remember what he did? I mean, instantaneously he said, get behind me, and what did he call him? Satan. Because he knew. He knew where that thought had come from. And so he said no immediately. It is much easier to say no to the first drink than it is to addiction. It's easier to say no to the first flirtation with somebody of the opposite sex than it is to put out the flames of an illicit affair. He'd say no immediately. And then finally this morning, we need to maintain our perspective. We need to maintain our perspective. I want you to look at the screen with me for just a second. Read this passage with me out of 2 Corinthians 4. Paul said, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Listen to what he says. We do not look at things that are seen. Things that are seen are temporary. Things that are unseen, not seen, those things are eternal. And the point of it is that it's really hard to give into temptation and stay there when your spiritual radar is really on, when you're serious about who you are, about whom you serve, about where you want to be when you die, when you are serious about those three things, when you're serious about the fact, as we saw the other night, that according to 1 Peter 2 and 9, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a person of God's own possession. When you're serious about belonging to the Lord and where you want to be when you die, it's hard to give in to temptation and decide to stay there. A while back, I was flipping channels, and I came across a program that was showing the pictures. It was entitled The Pictures That Impacted Our Life. And there were a lot of still frame pictures that you would recognize. They are famous images that have been captured of great events. And one of the images that really caught my attention was the image of Colonel Robert Stern returning to Travis Air Force Base in California from Vietnam. As an Air Force colonel, he had been shot down over Vietnam in 1967. He was captured and taken as a prisoner of war. His family wondered if they would ever see him alive again or not. In this picture, he is just off the plane, and he has just stepped onto the tarmac. And as you can see, his family is running to greet him. Out in front, there is a daughter who is 17 years old, and behind her is another teenage son, and behind him is a younger child, and behind her is Colonel Stern's wife. Face is beaming, arms outstretched. And the photographer entitled this picture, Burst of Joy. It makes me think about the burst of joy that we'll experience in heaven, the reunion with our loved ones, with moms and dads and grandparents and brethren that we've loved who have died. It makes me think about our admission into the very presence of God the Father and God the Son and God the Holy Spirit, an experience that our minds can hardly even begin to fathom. And faith will be made sight in all those times that we have sung, when we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be, and when we all sing Jesus, will sing and shout the victory. I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, whatever sacrifice you had to make, whatever temptation you had to overcome, it'll be worth it for that burst of joy. Thank you for listening so well this morning.